Majority Report, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. Even Saturday and Sunday are casual. Sorry, Jesus. So don't forget your denim hip huggers. Don't forget your bootcut jeans. We're not afraid of dungarees on the Majority Report.
That's right. It's Casual Friday, and that's all the time we have left for the program today, folks. It is Casual Friday, January 14th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Welcome. Just looking at the numbers here, I want to say welcome to some of our new listeners. I believe who are joining us. This is my guess. You never know. I mean, we don't. We are working, of course, with the NSA right now, and with some internet privacy spooks to figure out exactly who's watching us. I mean, yes, we can look at your IP addresses and find out what part of the country you're in, but we want to get it down to the house and the room in which you're listening. We want to, frankly, we want to know what you're wearing today. It's Casual Friday, and if we get enough Majority Report supporters, memberships, we will have the technology to actually basically reverse your stream. You'll be listening to us via audio, and we will implant certain digital packets which will allow us to watch you through video technology and determine whether or not you're, in fact, casually dressed on Casual Friday. Thanks for joining us. Now I should tell our new listeners that on Casual Friday, we're very casual. And once we've been working on phone technologies, and we're going to pull the plug within a week or two. No, excuse me, I said that the wrong way. We're going to. Yes. I just freaked out the staff a little bit. We're not going to pull the plug. We're going to. What's the word I'm looking for?
Plug something in.
No. I'm going to plug. Well, yeah, I guess we'll ultimately plug something in. We're going to figure out how to plug something in, and we're going to pull the trigger. That's the thing. I don't want to use such violent metaphors because some guy on my Twitter feed is going to say, oh, there you go. There you go.
You're trying to pull the plug on grandma again.
Exactly.
Keith.
Later in this program, we'll be talking to Chris Rosen, as we do every Friday, the senior elder editor at movieline.com, who will give us his weekly Netflix streaming and on-demand pick of the week, because I have a family and a child, and I don't have the opportunity to actually go to movies anymore, so I have to watch them on my TV at like 1 in the morning, after my daughter is done watching, you know, a cartoon or something. And so that's why we do that. And, you know, we try and keep it casual today on Casual Friday. And then later in the program for our post show, which is still available to everyone, you will be able to IM me at Majority FM on your chat client. Great piece by, let me just start with this. Hoyer, this is Steny Hoyer, the House Minority Whip, has signed on to a plan for bipartisan seating at the State of the Union Address. Great. I can't imagine anything being less relevant, but if they feel that it's going to help them move the country forward and to cut our Social Security and impose austerity on all the people who are not millionaires in this country, well, then God bless them. One could see the Steny Hoyer standing up. Look, guys, come on. We're all very rich here. I think we can get along. But, you know, Paul Krugman has a really a great piece in the New York Times today that, now, on this program, I am not shy about pointing out that I believe the Democratic Party and the Democratic establishment, the liberal establishment, in many ways, has a problem on economic issues, a major problem. I think, to a large extent, our lawmakers are owned by the banks, and I mean that across the board in terms of both Democrats and Republicans. And I believe that the Obama administration, that Obama himself, sees these Reubenites and these Larry Summers and these Tim Geithners and even Goolsbee and all of these neoliberals, these third wayers, like Bill Daley, his new chief of staff, former, just barely former, J.P. Morgan CEO. I mean, just like literally, he probably hasn't even handed in his key fob or his door pass. And I think Obama actually believes that these people are there because we have a perfectly working, functioning meritocracy, and that these people are masters of the universe. And if we need to pay billions and billions and billions of dollars to bankers and get nothing in return, and in no way to regulate them to keep the world chugging along, then that's what we'll do. I mean, I really believe that is a sincere belief. And but Krugman has a great piece today, not in any way disputing what I've just said, but delineating still that even if you accept that premise, which I just stated, even if you accept that premise, even if you accept the premise that the Obama administration could be out in front of cutting Social Security, there still is a fundamental difference between the ideologies in the parties. And, you know, this is the fact, folks. We had Digby on, I guess, earlier this week. Was it earlier this week? I don't know. Everything is blending in together to me. Can't even, I look at Evan and Dorsey, and I begin to think, when are your baby teeth falling out? That's how everything is blending in together for me. But Digby was on, and Digby made the point that, look, we can try and fight these tax cut battles. We can everything else is the bottom line is we as progressives, we as liberals, we have to take a defensive position now to protect Social Security. That is, and this onslaught of potential austerity programs that are coming. And frankly, I would add to that just the attacks on public and private unions in this country. And so, you know, things can change very quickly, and it's incredibly important to be engaged and educate your friends and family about these things, because what is going to be coming down the road, it is one thing to fight a Republican president when he's trying to destroy Social Security. It is another to fight a Democratic president who is willing to cut Social Security. Not eliminate it, but cut it. And that is, frankly, the fight and the agenda that gets me up in the morning. It would be very easy at a time like this to sort of fall into some despair and to fall into some deep well of cynicism. And believe me, I'm rather cynical. But there still is a fundamental difference between these parties, and there still is a fundamental difference between these ideologies. And, you know, I don't know what the odds are of success for these battles that we wage, but it almost doesn't matter. As long as the odds are not 0%, it is worth hanging in there, staying engaged, and having this fight. That's my feeling. And Krugman has this piece today A Tale of Two Moralities. On Wednesday, President Obama called on Americans to, quote, expand our moral imaginations, to listen to each other more carefully, to sharpen our instincts for empathy, and remind ourselves of all the ways our hopes and dreams are bound together. Krugman says, those were beautiful words. They spoke to our desire for reconciliation, but the truth is that we are a deeply divided nation and are likely to remain one for a long time. This is the point I was making yesterday when I was talking about these polls. And yes, I think on one level we have a shared humanity, and there is a spiritual and transcendent connection that we all should have as human beings, not just within the context of our nation, but frankly, in the context of our world. Now, I've already treaded into areas where our conservative friends would get a little freaked out. One world government you're talking about, Sam! And, you know, I think I mentioned earlier in the week where the cynical part of me hears people talking about, like, we're Americans. Can't we all just put aside our differences and at the end of the day go out and have a beer with each other and appreciate the fact that we're all Americans so that we can still maintain our resolve to kill people who are not from this country? We need to maintain a level of civility amongst ourselves so that we can still operate and function, so that we can, you know, kill civilians with drones. Right? Okay. Well, I'm going to turn off that cynicism for a moment and continue on with this piece, because on another level, there are very important battles, and I said this earlier this week and on Radigan, is like, look, politics are about life and death. And I'm not talking about what happened in Arizona. I'm talking about political policy decisions affect people's lives and can affect whether or not people live or die. Ask those two organ donors who couldn't, organ donor recipients or would-be organ donor recipients that died in Arizona because of cuts to the organ donor program. Ask some of the 45,000 people a year who die because they don't have health insurance, which allows them access to proper health care. Never mind ask the at least 100,000 civilians in Iraq who died because, I actually believe, because of a decision that was made by the Supreme Court to stop counting ballots in Florida. There's no direct line to these things, but I think that's a pretty darn close one, frankly. But be that as it may, Krugman writes, one side of American politics considers the modern welfare state a private enterprise economy, but one in which society's winners are taxed to pay for a social safety net. Morally superior to the capitalism red in tooth and claw we had before the New Deal. It's only right, this side believes, for the affluent to help the less fortunate. I think that would be the perspective of Krugman. That is the perspective of mine. I would go a little further on some level in saying that it's not simply a arbitrary decision, but comes out of one belief that there are certain aspects to society that cannot be owned, that are owned by all of us, the commons. But let's stick with what Krugman is, how he is delineating this. The other side believes that people have a right to keep what they earn and that taxing them to support others, no matter how needy, amounts to theft. That's what lies behind the modern right's fondness for violent rhetoric. Many activists on the right really do see taxes and regulation as tyrannical impositions on their liberty. Krugman goes on to say there is no middle ground between these views. And I think he's right. And that's why I asked that Twitter guy the other day, do you think we're living under a tyranny? One side saw health reform with its subsidized extension of coverage to the uninsured, adding something like 30 million people to health insurance roles. As fulfilling a moral imperative, or it will add in 2014, wealthy nations, it believed, have an obligation to provide for all their citizens with essential care. The other side saw the same reform as a moral outrage, an assault on the right of Americans to spend their money as they choose. This deep divide in American political morality is a relatively recent development. Commenters who pine for the days of civility and bipartisanship are, whether they realize it or not, pining for the days when the Republican Party accepted the legitimacy of the welfare state and was even willing to contemplate expanding it. This is the thing that people do not realize, just how far right the Republican Party has moved. He goes on to say, as many analysts have noted, the Obama health care reform, whose passage was met with vandalism and death threats against members of Congress, was modeled on Republican plans from the 1990s. That's how far to the right, how quickly this country has moved. And I would argue that during that time in the early 90s, when Bob Dole had this plan, even in the beginning of this decade, or the last decade, it was Mitt Romney's plan in Massachusetts. At that time, there was growing foment on the right that had just not quite broken through the mainstream. Limbaugh et al. Was whipping this up in a sort of more hermetically sealed bubble, and it simply broke through. They took over the Republican Party. This was the
FUBAR, America's right-wing nightmare.
That was essentially the thesis of the bathroom reading book that Stephen Sherrill and I wrote in 2006, that the Republican Party had been taken over by this virulent strain of the right, both these free market fundamentalists and these religious moral majoritarians. But that was then, Krugman says. Today's GOP sees much of what the modern federal government does as illegitimate. Today's Democratic Party does not. When people talk about partisan difference, they often seem to be implying that these differences are petty, matters that could be resolved with a bit of goodwill. But what we're talking about here is a fundamental disagreement about the proper role of government. And the question now is, what can we agree on given this deep national divide? In a way, politics as a whole now resembles the longstanding politics of abortion. I think this is an incredibly salient point. Because you can't even have a legitimate argument about abortion anymore. Maybe you never could. A subject that puts fundamental values at odds, in which each side believes the other side is morally in the wrong. Almost 38 years have passed since Roe v. Wade, and this dispute is no closer to resolution. And I do not think it's a coincidence. It's an apt analogy, but there is another correlation here. You'll remember that in the 70s, as the corporations and essentially the moneyed elite in this country became very worried about the middle class, the expansion and security of the middle class in this country, which was leading to them taking more political power, as evidenced by the idea of a middle class kid being willing to get arrested in college to protest things without any fear that this was going to affect his ability, his financial security in the future. And it is in the 70s when we see this growing influence on our politics of corporations and money. Jacob Hacker, who was on this program now a couple of months ago, with his book, Winner Take All Politics with Paul Pearson, outlines how this actually started during the Carter administration. And certainly Bill Clinton was also part and parcel of this sort of neoliberal agenda. And, of course, Reagan, we all know very well, carried out this agenda on steroids. But this has been a marked shift in our politics when corporations basically said, hey, we're losing this battle, or we need to make sure that we never lose this battle. And part of that was the right essentially adopting this notion of anti-abortion politics in the late 70s. when it was Richard Viguerie, I think, went and met with Jerry Falwell and said, hey, wait a second. You know, and Jerry Falwell, who had never taken up this issue, this was a way of doing it. And I think they saw this social issue as a way of creating a wedge which they could then bleed in and provide at least electoral power to pursue a more corporatist and money-driven agenda. He goes on to say, yet we have, for the most part, managed to agree on certain ground rules in the abortion controversy. It's acceptable to express your opinion and to criticize the other side, but it's not acceptable to either to engage in violence or to encourage others to do so. What we need now is an extension of those ground rules in a wider debate. It's not enough to appeal to the better angels of our nature. We need to have leaders of both parties, or Mr. Obama alone if necessary, declare that both violence and any language hinting at the acceptability of violence are out of bounds. And that is true. But I think, and you know, the implication there being that by Krugman is that he has not, that Obama has not been specific enough about the purveyors of this violence. But that is less relevant to me than his outlining of just how far apart in worldview we are and what those worldviews are. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking to Christopher Rosen from Movie Line. He's going to give us some movie selections. And then after that, I'm going to give you a perfect example of the worldview that Krugman describes on the right. I mean, a stark, perfect example coming from a Republican U.S. senator. But first, we'll be right back in just a moment with Chris Rosen. We are back on our telephonic device. And I'm not being cute there. It is actually not a telephone. Is Chris Rosen. He is the senior editor of MovieLine.com. Now, just to clarify, there is no junior editors. There's just, I guess, a senior editor. And I can appreciate that. When I worked at Cafe China back in Inman Square in Somerville, Mass., many, many years ago, I dubbed myself the day manager. Now, granted, I was the only person working during the day, but if there's no one to complain about your taking a title, then you deserve that title. Now, let me ask you to do one thing, Chris.
What's
How about
that?
Not doing other work while you're on the show? I
you
can hear you typing.
You were insulting me with your introduction. I thought I could type away.
No, I wasn't insulting you. I was trying
I
was trying to say that it's perfectly legitimate for you to call yourself whatever you want if there's no one there to complain.
I don't make up the titles. That's what they call me. I mean, you know, that's what it is.
All right.
You know.
Who called you that? The chief prefect of Movie
Come
Line?
On. I mean, come on. We have a nice editorial staff. There's a lot of people on staff, you know.
Does that person who hired site. You refer to them as the emperor of Movie Line?
No.
Okay. I'm just curious. I mean, because, you know, if there's nobody there to complain, they can call themselves whatever they want.
MovieLine.com, folks.
MovieLine.com. Okay. Now, Chris Rosen, of course, comes on. He gives us a Netflix streaming suggestion and an on-demand suggestion.
Yes.
Now, last week you suggested The Town.
Yes.
And what was the other one you suggested?
Right. Joan Rivers.
Oh, right, Joan Rivers. Now, Joan Rivers I had already seen,
yes.
And I would give that a thumbs up, but with qualifications, but definitely worth a watch. And I watched The Town.
And what'd you think?
Now, listen, I am partial to films about Charleston or Somerville or Billerica,
yeah,
or Stoughton, Medford, Milford, Marblehead, Gloucester, Rockport, Lowell, of course, Worcester, my hometown, Fitchburg, Leominster, Holden, Whitensville. Nothing west of Auburn, though. No, I thought it was a fun movie. I thought it was a fun movie. My wife liked it. It wasn't too violent. You know, like, if I can watch an action film, and I thought the directing was sort of crappy up front, but then it got good. When he decided to calm down and, you know, not, you know, when he realized, like, after the first 2 days of shooting, like, shit, I'm not fucking Coppola. I'm not Scorsese. Fuck it. I'm just going to do this movie and just get it done. And that was actually when it started getting better. And it was directed by Affleck, right?
It was directed by Affleck.
Yeah, what steroids has that dude been taking?
I don't know. He's jacked, right? And yeah. He throws in shots of him doing the pull-ups, which I just think is funny. That's like, you know, why not?
I got news for you. I can understand that, because when you have a body like that, you really want to show it off. And that's that's why, you know, I don't do pull-ups.
I think that's a good movie. I think it's a lot of fun. I don't think he's a very good director. You're right. There's nothing really special about what he does directing. I think he gets a lot more credit than he deserves because he's an actor, and that means the scale is a lot lower. You know what I mean? Like,
you know, as a former actor-director, I sort of resent that.
Well, I'm just saying.
Okay.
In most cases, I think most people are like, wow. And that's not even – that could also be because it's Ben Affleck. I mean, he does have – he had a reputation of being like a kind of a joke.
You know. Look, you know, it's a pretty good movie.
I think it's a good movie. I love it. It's a lot of fun.
It's not so violent that you can't watch it with somebody who doesn't like violence.
No, it was not really violent. Not a lot of blood. It's R, I guess, but not crazy violent.
So, you know, I got to give you a 2 for 2 for last week, Chris. I think that's the best week you've had so far.
Yes. Well, this week I'll do my best to do terrible this week then. 0 for 2.
Okay, so let's see. What else you got?
So we'll do on demand first. I'd like to bring up the film Catfish. Have you heard of it?
Catfish?
Yes.
No, I haven't, but Dorsey seems to have.
It's a documentary. It's controversial in that you don't know if it's actually real or not. Basically, it's about these brothers, you know, one guy's a filmmaker and one guy's just like, you know, whatever he does. He's just like a hipster doofus. And he gets into a Facebook relationship with this girl and her family, and you know, he's like, oh, she's like, they're all artists, and she's pretty hot and stuff, and he's like, oh, I'm really into it, and I'm like falling in love with her. And anyway, I'm not going to spoil anything for you, obviously, but he goes to meet her, and you know, things happen. So, and it's supposed to be like a real thing, like they marketed it as like a thrilling, like a thriller documentary, but
okay.
It's not like, you know, a lot of people are like, oh, is it real? Maybe. It really might be. You know, you never know if it's real or not. It's one of those things like, I guess, like I'm Still Here, which obviously, you know, is fake now. That was the Joaquin Phoenix one.
Well, I'll tell you something. If you're asking whether or not it's real or fake, then it's fake.
It's fake, of course.
Because otherwise, they just come out and go, no, this is real.
Right. So, and you know,
but
the
fine.
Guys
that's
who did
okay.
it are, yeah, it's fun. So I think that would be a decent one to watch. At least it'll be a talking point type thing for you and your wife, maybe, where you can, like, you know, bat it back
I doubt
and forth
it.
A little.
There's very little that we can actually have that's a conversation it, huh? with that doesn't end up with recriminations, even if it's, particularly if it's film. Particularly if
and
it's
that's
film.
On that's on demand, so you could find that on demand.
The only thing we can seem to do these days is just drink. That's the only thing that we're, yeah, and then
that's
it's usually
a good thing to have in common.
Right, okay.
It works for Don Draper, so.
Right.
And all his girls.
Oh, gosh. It's name drop.
John Hamm.
What was
Do you know John Hamm?
I do know John. I met John Hamm at a party in. Was that what?
You're going to name
Oh, right. Oh, and at that same party. Unfortunately, I'm spreading it out because I don't go to many parties. And it could be when Sarah. I'm sorry. Sarah Silverman. Invited me to her birthday party, which now was almost 2 months ago. Not only did I meet John Hamm there, who complimented me on one of my television shows, Beat
What
Cops.
Was the show he complimented
Beat
you
Cops.
On?
It's not a big deal.
Beat Cops, right.
I also met Ron Howard.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's not a big deal. All
Ron
right,
Howard,
name drop
nice,
Friday. What?
Very nice guy, Ron Howard.
He was to me. I mean, he didn't, you know.
I think he's very nice.
Well, I mean, when you're a movie critic, you get, you don't really get the same perspective as you would if you were at a
movie star
Hollywood
like yourself.
Party. So, yeah. You know. All right, and what's the second movie?
The second one now.
Name Drop Friday.
In the Boston Family. This is on Netflix Instant Watch. Shutter Island. I don't know if you saw that.
I didn't see that, but it's like some type of like psychological thriller.
It's a psychological thriller. There are some problems with it. It's from a craft standpoint, it's infinitely better than The Town because it is Martin Scorsese and not Ben Affleck pretending to be Martin Scorsese. So from a technical standpoint, you're going to be like, wow, this looks really good and stuff. And you have all the same Boston accents. Leonardo DiCaprio, who did it in The Departed, he's still pretty good at it. Mark Ruffalo is also in it. Not as good. You know, some of them are really, it's really like ham-fisted, a lot of the accents. And I think it's a very broad film, and it's like, it's kind of like a 50s or 60s melodrama at times, where like, it's very broad and very obvious, and like, it's really kind of, you know, like a lot of like, you know, jump cuts or like lightning to like, you know, like connotate something that would be scary. And it's also a psychological thriller. The problem is, if you're paying attention, you will figure out what the thrilling aspect of it is, like pretty early on.
Right.
And they don't really tell you that until the end. So I'm not going to spoil it for you. I will say that Michelle Williams is in it in a very small role.
Wait a second, Michelle Williams?
From Dawson's Creek, or did you meet her also somewhere?
She's
also in Blue Valentine. She was married. She had Heath Ledger's baby.
No, I don't know any of those people you just referenced. Or
you don't know
shows.
Who Heath Ledger is?
Wait,
never heard of Heath Ledger.
He's the guy who died.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. No, I do know him.
Okay.
I mean, not
so
personally.
Michelle Williams was. Oh,
I think I knew. I think I knew Kim Williams. Who is the girl on According to Jim?
Wendy Williams. No, I don't know.
Courtney Thorne Smith.
Courtney Thorne Smith, of course, I knew because I was on the pilot of According to Jim. But there was also another, her sister.
Oh,
Lord. Kimberly Williams. Yes.
Kimberly Williams. Right.
This is not Kimberly Williams.
Say this if it wasn't Name Drop Friday.
Right. Anyway, Michelle Williams did it. She's absolutely fantastic. She's getting a lot of, you know, Oscar buzz for Blue Valentine, which she's in, and she'll probably get nominated. Don't worry about it. But she's really, really good in this, and it's really sad, and it kind of gets incredibly sad at the end, but I think it's a good movie, and I think
you didn't give it a very good review for a movie. You think it's good? I mean, it's like it's got a really weak
because I just don't want you to have your expectations. I didn't say it had a weak surprise. I just said you'll figure it out because you're a smart guy. I figure you'll figure it out.
That's probably true.
I think I figured it out from the trailer, but
yeah, you could definitely figure out. I mean, you definitely can. It's very obvious, but it's a good movie, and Leonardo DiCaprio is good.
Okay.
And I like Leonardo DiCaprio, and it's again Boston. So,
that's Netflix streaming. And Catfish is on demand. Is that it?
Catfish is on demand.
And, how much? It's not like one of the $6.99.
No, it's like $4.99. And Netflix Instant Watch.
Raise the price on those. It used to be $3.99.
I know. What are they doing?
It's crazy.
It's HD.
Speaking of Massachusetts accents, I guess.
Yeah.
I had to work on a project at my other job, and it was gathering together all of Kevin Costner's awful, awful accents. And there was a lot of Massachusetts accents.
He's in a new movie in The Company Man, Kevin Costner.
Oh, and he has a Boston accent.
Yes, it's terrible.
Yeah, I mean, Boston accents, you know, because they're distinct, but then everybody goes for like the most Boston of Boston accents, and.
I'll give you a great one for Boston accents. I know we have to go, and I know you don't go to movies. But The Fighter with Christian Bale and Mark Wahlberg is an outstanding movie, and it is hilarious Boston accents.
Well, Wahlberg should have an ear for it. I mean, he grew up in Southie, so.
And Christian Bale, who's British, does a great one where he's like, "Where's the fucking car?" You know, like it's just like
everybody does Kennedy.
It's really good. I mean, if you want Boston accents and a good fight movie, like you should see that. It's a lot of fun.
Well, but that's in the theater, right?
That's in the theater. So we'll talk about
that
6 months
until
from now.
That gets onto Netflix.
6 months later. It's 6 months. Let's hold this conversation. 6 months from now, we'll pick it back up.
All right, great. Well, right. Chris Rosen, I encourage everyone to go over to
MovieLine.com.
MovieLine.com.
Yeah.
And you know, now is it just you over there? Or is this whole like company?
No, it's a whole company. We have a huge staff. We have a lot of good hires.
Do you guys even have an office?
We do. I work from home, but we do.
Yeah, I know that. It's people don't realize that I can see you on video chat, and it really always looks like it. Always looks like I like every time we go into break after this segment, I always say to like Dorsey, like it could be time for an intervention.
I'm in clothes. I have a sweater on and jeans.
All right, great. Keep that up. Keep up the good work.
Yeah, I will. I'll talk to you next week. Next week, I promise, I'm going to come in, so we'll be able to do this in person.
All right, very excited for that.
Yeah, I know. I am too.
Bye. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back, and we will talk about that very real distinction on a vision of what this country is supposed to be right after this. We're going to be back. We're back. Pixies, University of Massachusetts. That's not one of their most melodious tunes. Saw the Pixies many times in Boston, back in the day.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Were they good live back then?
Yeah. Yeah, of course. You know who was not good live? Mudhoney.
I can see that.
They just sat there, and I was just like, their music's so much more exciting when you did not see them perform it.
I saw them, and they had a terrible, terrible band open up for them, and that made them better when I saw them. They were really loud, though, like really loud.
Well, it's, you know, it's Mudhoney. All right, so, you know, we're talking about Paul Krugman's distinction between those people who think that that just the concept of taxes is tyrannical, and those people who feel that society's winners have an obligation to help out those people who are not winning in society. And by extension, both these perspectives, the latter perspective, the one that I subscribe to, and I suspect many of you subscribe to, is based on the idea that, look, we all pay dues into this society. You can think of it as a club. And at the beginning, as we enter into this society or club, nobody knows who's going to get more advantage out of the club than others. Now, truth be told, you can predict quite well who's going to get a better advantage out of this club based upon your birth. I think I can tell you within a 70 to 80%, 85% assuredness, based simply on where you're born, what your race is, how much money your parents have, and in what era you were born, as to where you will be when you're 65 years old. That's just the fact. That's just the reality. I know that's a very disturbing concept to people who have either pulled themselves up by their bootstraps or not. But that, and there is 15% out there, that 20% out there that can change that get lucky, that break out of those things. But that's simply the fact. And the liberal progressive vision of this country is such that we all have a society is here to enrich, to embetter everyone. That's why we have organized. Otherwise, we might as well just go to a feudal system. And here we have Senator Mike Lee from Utah, who's posted a lecture on a YouTube channel, which is a lengthy defense, this I'm getting from Think Progress, of a very radical perception of the Constitution. And that is that it is to be read literally, although literally when they want to read it literally, but it is to be read extremely narrowly, that the document was not created with any sense that things would change in the future, that the document was not created in such a way that it would have a flexibility to deal with changing technology and growth of the country, and simply changes in the world. I mean, it just was, it's a fundamentalist reading of the Constitution this guy has. And as such, what you're going to hear Mike Lee argue is that child labor laws are unconstitutional. That federal, I should say, child labor laws are unconstitutional. Now, off the top of my head, I believe child labor laws came in as a function of, well, maybe it was the 40-hour work week and other labor laws that came in as a function of a Brandeis brief when Louis Brandeis went out in front of the Supreme Court. But I'm not 100% sure on that. But he makes an argument that federal child labor laws are unconstitutional because the federal government has no right to involve themselves in the freedom of the contract. Now, you will not find the words freedom of contract in the Constitution, but it is interpreted as to be there from property rights and liberty. Because you're allowed to interpret that, but you're not allowed to interpret anything else of the Constitution. I would remind Mike Lee that things like general welfare are also in the Constitution. Welfare, the word welfare. Okay, so let's play this clip. Listen carefully as Senator Mike Lee makes the argument that child labor laws are unconstitutional. This was all done by Hoodwink. And and then at the very end, he just sort of says, oh, but they came in anyways.
Okay. Like, for example, child labor. Shortly after the turn of the last century, there was a problem with a lot of people using children as workers in their factories. It was a barbaric practice. It was awful. They were sweatshops. These children who should have been in schools were working very long shifts, 10, 12, 14-hour days in factories. Congress decided it wanted to prohibit that practice, so it passed a law. No more child labor. The Supreme Court heard a challenge to that law. And the Supreme Court decided a case in 1918 called Hammer versus Dagenhart. In that case, the Supreme Court acknowledged something very interesting. That as reprehensible as child labor is, and as much as it ought to be abandoned, that's something that has to be done by state legislators, not by members of Congress. Why? Well, because labor and manufacturing, as the Supreme Court explained, are activities that take place in one state at one time. They are, by their very nature, local activities. And while they may have some commercial aspects to them, they are not themselves interstate commercial transactions. So Congress enacted this law based on the idea that because labor and manufacturing are commercial activities, because Congress has the power to regulate interstate commerce, that must be enough to give them this power. The Supreme Court said no. The fact that it's commercial isn't enough. It's got to be interstate and commercial. This is local. So the law's no good. It's unconstitutional. As laudable as its objectives may be, the law is no good. This may sound harsh, but it was designed to be that way. It was designed to be a little bit harsh, not because we like harshness for the sake of harshness, but because we like a clean division of power so that everybody understands whose job it is to regulate what. Now, we got rid of child labor, notwithstanding this case. And so the entire world did not implode as a result of that ruling. Quite to the contrary, we continued on for the next few years with an understanding of the sharp division that exists between state power, which is local, and federal power, which is national, and which has to be set forth in this document.
Now, when he says, like, but child labor laws came in anyways, what he fails to mention is that that court case that he was referring to was overruled.
Right.
And now contemplate his argument here. Can you imagine if child labor laws were instituted in, let's say, New York, but not in New Jersey? Would that affect interstate commerce? I mean, would it? I mean, aside from the fact that presumably in New Jersey, nothing would have to, would everything need to be consumed and produced with inside New Jersey. But it would also cause commerce to change from New York, right? I mean, and the Supreme Court ultimately decided that economic activity can be regulated by Congress because the Constitution gives the Congress the power not only to regulate commerce among several states, but to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying these into execution to regulate this commerce. And whether you're Scalia, who is the most freakish of these freaks on the Supreme Court, agrees that states have these powers. And, in fact, the court unanimously overruled the Hammer v. Dagenhart decision, which Mike Lee refers to, in 1941, in United States v. Darby. And he doesn't go on to explain this, but the Think Progress points out that the reason why child labor has largely disappeared is because Congress placed very strict limits on child labor law when it enacted the Fair Labor Standards of 1938. And I think it was Darby, actually, where we had the Brandeis brief, if I'm not mistaken.
I think so, yeah.
And that's when all of the constitutional questions surrounding the Fair Labor Standards of 1938 were resolved. Things like, is it legal for a 40-hour work week? Is it legal to have a minimum wage? Does the state have a vested interest in creating a 40-hour work week? Does the state have a vested interest in not allowing for child labor? Does the state have a vested interest in imposing a federal minimum wage? Or a ban on whites-only counters, for that matter? Right? I mean, the Civil Rights Act and any type of legislation in terms of, like, you cannot... I mean, this is the same argument that I think Rachel Maddow had with Rand Paul, right? I mean, Rand Paul believes that you cannot legislate to a private business that they can't discriminate. Because the Constitution doesn't allow you to. Now, here's the fact. The fact is that the Constitution doesn't do either. It does not explicitly allow you or disallow you to do either. All men created equal, except for most of the years that the Constitution was in effect, black people didn't have the right to vote. It wasn't all men are created equal who own property and are white and are not women. I mean, the Constitution says all men are created equal. So does that mean that women do not have the same constitutional rights as men? If you are to believe Mike Lee, that is the only conclusion you can get. The only. The only. We hear, right-wingers say all the time, the Constitution's not a suicide pact. So in their mind, you can bend the Constitution, but only if it's to create a big brother state and it's a Republican president. Because you don't hear that much these days, do you? This is a fundamental distinction. As corporatist as Democrats have become in some respects, they still believe that we have a society which can impose child labor laws. We still have a government that is in its rights to create a 40-hour work week or to have a minimum wage or to impose taxes for that matter. They're not imposing enough as far as I'm concerned. But that's the primary distinction. And if we were to follow the vision of these right-wingers, I mean, frankly, I would love an opportunity to follow Mike Lee's version of America for like 6 months. Because if we did, and understand that even under complete Republican control, under Bush, under a Republican Congress, under a Republican Senate, we didn't even come close to this vision. They spent money. They expanded Medicare Part D. They would never govern in this way. Never. Because it would be the end of their ideology. Because I got news for you. The American public will not stand for a destruction of child labor laws. Well, we still got them. It's just in 4 or 5 states. That's just... All right. A little shorter show today. I'm going to take a break. When we come back, I will take your IMs. I've got a story about charter schools. I've got tons of stories. Oh, you know what? Wait a second. Hold on. Let me read this. I want to read this email for a second. Put that music down for a second. I apologize. I want to thank, as I read these emails, our incredibly generous and helpful Majority Report member of an incredible designation, Eric, who has not only been incredibly generous in supporting this program, but also he's been very helpful. He's been sending a bunch of stories, too. And I get a whole stack here. I don't even have time to go through them. But and just for house cleaning, on Monday, we will... I think our show will probably consist only of some selects from Martin Luther King speeches. So we will not be live. I want to read this email because this is the second one I've gotten almost exactly like this in the past 2 days. Dear Sam, I had intended to sponsor your program next month at the Majority Reporter level. The other person who wrote us had to cancel her subscription. Now, the issue isn't that. You'll understand why I'm reading this. But I don't think I'll be able to, thanks to the odd letter I received from the Social Security Administration just this week. It says that next month California will stop paying my Medicare premiums starting last month, in other words. California has decided to retroactively stop paying my Medicare premiums from December 2010 and bill me in 2011 for December, January, and February combined. So they're getting a retroactive bill. Like obviously, it amounts to $324, well over a third of my monthly disability allotment of $854. Since my subsidized low-income apartment already costs nearly half my allotment, I will likely go hungry next month, as sometimes happens when something unexpected occurs. That's what austerity feels like. In addition to the fact that, you know, I've now gotten too many emails about what's going on in California with the Medicare premiums. This is the reality for a lot of our fellow Americans. Now, you know, the issue isn't this person's membership to this program, and I hope I've made it clear to everyone, and I will continue to do so via email, that, you know, people in these type of situations will not be, when we sequester the show, will not be denied access. But I bring this up because if Mike Lee and the right in this country had their way, this person who emailed me would not be enjoying the life of luxury of $500 a month of expendable income after rent. Would not be enjoying the life of luxury of I'm going to have to skip meals next month. They wouldn't even have that. In the 1920s, as we go down to the Bowery and walk up and down there and see the nice shops now, and it's all been gentrified and renovated, understand that there were 30,000 people living on that street. Not in the buildings. On the street. This is less than 100 years ago. There were 30,000 people who were living on a stretch of like 7-8 blocks. Very relevant as we start to talk about cutting Social Security, which is going to be next on the docket, folks. And there's a lot of people who are already starting to gear up again, and we're going to start talking about it a lot.
And just as an example, that's California, where the Democrats killed in the midterms.
That's right.
Jerry Brown's the governor, and that's what's happening over there. It's coming.
Well, we have a tremendous amount of malfeasance over there in terms of the budget woes. And this is what austerity is going to look like, because it is fundamentally tyrannical to raise taxes above the present level, which is the lowest level they have been in personal income taxes in 70 years. 80 years. Because if we raise them up to where they were under Clinton, or where they were under Carter, or where they were under Reagan's first years, or where they were under Ford, or Nixon, or Johnson, or Kennedy, or Eisenhower, we'll be living in a tyranny. Be right back. I'll take your IMs on the other side. So do we know who's going to be on next week?
I haven't heard any confirmations, but we've sent her these requests.
Who, Jessica? Oh, you know what I forgot to do was the Creation Museum. I'm going to have to do that Monday.
Yeah.
No, Monday, wow, I'm so backed up, man. And in a good way, not in the bad way as the 2 weeks. You know what we're going to do right now?
You're going to call Jessica.
I'm going to call Jessica.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
can you hear me? Is it ringing? You got my computer going?
There it is.
Hello? Do you hear anything?
No.
Hello? Hold on. I hope she's not mad about this.
This has worked out so well for us in the past.
Oh, John Benjamin started talking to me again.
Jessica Magley, I'm sorry I missed your call. Please leave your name and phone number, and I'll get back to you as soon as possible. Thanks very much for calling. Take care.
At the tone, please record your message. When you've finished recording, you may hang up or press 1 for more options. To leave a callback number, press 5.
Hi, Jess. It's Sam Cedar. All of us, and by all of us, I mean thousands of people want to leave a message for you, asking you who do we have on next week? And also, we all wanted to remind you that we're going to be taking the day off for Martin Luther King's birthday. Hello? Are you screening this? No, it's voicemail, right? Okay. Bye.
Remember when you used to be able to screen phone calls with an answering machine?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those were good days.
Well, you know, you can, you still, there's technologies out there where you can, like, supposedly screen stuff like that. I don't know. I want to read another email from, also, Ramey, also a very generous, a very generous supporter of this program. And, you know, look, you know, you there's a lot of different ways to be a generous supporter of this program. You know, you can email us and say, hey, I'm willing to, you know, to help promote the show by putting, you know, getting accounts at different websites or sites that I might have accounts on. And I post links to the show. I post YouTubes. I retweet your Twitter feed. There's a lot of different things you can do. I contribute content to Majority Reporter's Tumblr site. Avant, who does our show rundown, has, you know, radically changed our lives and our perspective on humanity. Or you send stories at majorityreporters@gmail.com that I may or may not get to on any given day. I may just have in the back of my mind, and then 3 months later I connect something from that story, and it's very helpful. I mean, you know, I have a pile here of stories that I didn't get to today that I will inevitably bring up at one point or another, whether it's Murdoch's, you know, iPad thing that he's doing with Steve Jobs. There's an interesting story out of the Las Vegas Sun that Eric sent me about a company that seems to professionally sue people for copyright infringement online. They never win. It just seems to be slap suits to scare people. Piece about net neutrality facing legal battles, which I think, you know, we had a couple of guests on who anticipated this was going to be the case, because I can never pronounce his name. The FCC refused to classify internet under their Title II classification, which would have erased any question as to whether or not they could regulate them in any certain way. Got a story about traders, commodity traders, complaining about their bonuses. Still, they get paid more than, like, brain surgeons and generals.
Where's that crybaby button when you need it?
Bernanke saying job growth. I mean, I get a lot of stories from people. This charter school story was sent by a listener. Admittedly, I had come across it anyways, but it's fascinating because, you know, we hear so much about the incredible success of charter schools, and I've watched the movie, and, you know, the guy who did Enron movie, and how can you be against success? Well, some charter schools are great, but there are more bad charter schools by percentage than there are public schools. And charter schools are meant to be testing grounds to essentially inject new ideas and new MOs into our education system. They're not meant to supplant it. A voucher system isn't going to do anything except for drain the public school system and essentially make it a second-tier education. We'll have two classes or three classes of education in this country. So Ross Global Academy, a charter school founded by the widow of a media executive, is upset because the city is shutting it down. They are complaining that they're getting that some other charter school is getting preferential treatment because of political connections, which I have no doubt. I got news for you. That's the way charter schools work. It's political connections. But what they seem to be ignoring is that the school is failing in almost every measure. Now, I'm not a big advocate of using test scores as a way of judging anything, particularly schools, because I think it just leads to poor education. But it has faced what the Times refers to as endless problems, from violence in the school to unusually high staff turnover to poor test scores. Officials noted that more than 40% of Ross's teachers left each year, including 77% last year. If you cannot retain more than 23% of your teachers in your fifth year, there's something wrong with the school. And it's not helping the students. I imagine that's indicative of poor leadership at the school, poor discipline at the school. I don't know what, but there's a problem there, a significant problem. 5 years into it, where you have a 77% turnover rate? That's crazy. It was on its, and part of it is, it's on its sixth principal during its brief existence of 5 years. I've been in an exact situation like this. It was called Air America. It's not working. And it's one thing to allow a private entrepreneur to come in and spend their money, but are we going to spend more money on this charter school? It made the least progress of any lower school in the city last year. This is according to a spokeswoman for the Department of Education. You know, the city gives free space in existing public schools to many of these charter schools. So it is a drain on the public education system. And the return should be that ideas come from these schools and filter into the public education. You simply cannot supplant public schools. Is it a perfect system? No. Is it a near-perfect system? No. Are there problems with it? Yes. But that's the problems you're going to face in trying to educate the children of 300 million people in a country. And particularly in a country that doesn't seem to value education in the way that it should, in the way that people who are educated are derided, where science, forgot to read the creation book today, science is actively attacked by museums that suggest that dinosaurs walked the earth with men 6,000 years ago, and the proof being a flag of a dragon from Scotland. I mean, the notion that we can educate anybody in this country is shocking. When you have an active anti-education, anti-intellectual movement in this country like we have. The fact that we can educate anybody is surprising. When there is an active agenda to dumb people down. We will get more into education in this program as the days and months wear on. Okay, I'll take some quick Sarah the Surveyor. Yo, Sammy, K Posse, it was great to see you on Countdown last night instead of that mean other guy who calls me an idiot. Sarah the Surveyor. I really liked it when Dave Weigel called me a gladiator, too. I guess he knows. I'm a surveyor who can kick butt. Also, it's really super to do, but no, I have your vote for the Republican nomination in 2012. You're a real grizzly club, Sam. Whoopsie, I meant kick some butt. Harold. You did great last night. Any word on Olbermann still being ill? I imagine he'll want the long weekend. Yes, But I imagine they'll get Chris Hayes for tonight. Didn't Coster do 13 days? Wasn't that full of Boston accents? I don't know. Dorsey says yes. Zach Punk, it's a quaint notion to think we can overcome our divisions, but it's equally quaint to think our divisions are valid. Our division is stoked by massive misinformation campaigns from the right, which goes largely unchallenged by the media. It's not enough to just accept we're divided. We have to expose the frauds that divide us. I agree. Divisions, I mean, I don't know. Look, it's hard to say that divisions are invalid. But I do think that we can overcome them by presenting more information. But I get your point. Avant. Can't stick around for the whole show, but I'll have the recap done in the afternoon. Great job on Countdown last night, Avant. Thank you so much. Please never apologize to me. don't be a pot. Say, Sam, you know the people that love Obama so much that they will defend him no matter how much he behaves like a corporatist or how many times he breaks campaign promises or capitulates the Republicans to the status quo. I think they're really the left version of the birthers and that they're also true believers. They just happen to be pro-Obama. My question for you, Sam, is how did Andy Kindler become one of those people? I'll ask him.
Name drop Friday.
You know, we didn't go into the Reed, save that Reed defending Social Security. It'll be 2 weeks long, but it's the same thing, and save Obama's Social Security. Well, look, you know, I don't think that there, I just don't think that there has been the education, you know. I mean, I think you have to be very in tune with politics to fully grasp what's going on. And it's a very difficult needle to thread because I would rather Obama than a Republican. Though I'm not sure I wouldn't rather a Bloomberg instead of a Republican, depending on what Obama does. I mean, you know, I don't know how to really put that in any other way. And, you know, I do nothing but read this stuff every day. I read every news story and every analysis by people significantly more intelligent than me. And I still don't know what the answer is, other than pick a couple of issues and hold the line on those issues. And if Obama is an ally in those issues, great. And if he's not, then whatever. Real goal of charter schools and so-called education reform is really about deprofessionalizing the job of teachers. They want teachers to be expendable as Walmart or McDonald's workers. Diane Ravitch has written extensively on this topic. She is on my list to get her on this program. Jay Shivone, song called UMass, not University of Massachusetts, but a welcome addition nonetheless.
That's true. Right. I took some liberties.
I understand. Oh, David, I did get your graphics. I'm sorry I haven't gotten back to you. It's been crazy. He sent more.
Beautiful.
And I like them. But I'll send you an email. How come we never hear the strict constitutionalists argue that the Second Amendment applies only to single-shot, muzzle-loaded flintlocks of the 1790s? Yes, good point. Someone breaks into your house, you'd pull your flintlock and yell, "Stand and deliver, sir!" Thanks, Kev. Morella, fantastic show today at your casual best. Thank you. MacMan 851, as a creationist, I don't see how having alternate scientific theories could be considered attacking science. If someone points out a different point of view, you should consider the evidence and not say they are attacking you. Well, A, MacMan, with all due respect, if you're a creationist, you don't have an alternate scientific theory. You have an alternate theory that is based on religion. It's not scientific. There's no science involved in what you're doing. B, the Creationist Museum was explicitly set up to combat the worldview that is being spread by museums of natural history. I have that guy on tape from Answers in Genesis telling me that. This museum was built with that in mind, specifically. We see creationists getting on school boards and attempting to change the curriculum based on what you're talking about. I have no problem with someone having a creationist worldview. I do have a problem with it being called a scientific theory. I do have a problem with it being used to supplant scientific theories. I personally obviously disagree with the notion that the world is 10,000 years old. I don't think that there's a cabal of scientists mismeasuring, using scientific means of dating fossils and carbon degradation as a means of duping the world, which is implicit if you say that the idea that humans were alive 400,000 years ago is wrong. I don't mind people having their faith, but that's what it is. It's faith. And if you want to believe that narrative, I certainly believe certain religious narratives. And spiritual narratives. But if you want to believe that narrative, that's your decision. But it's very dangerous to, I believe, to use it as a means and see it as a competing version of science. Because what it does is it means that we can have no objective reality. It is, I mean, there's a reason why Gertrude Himmelfarb specifically said that conservatism is seeking to challenge ideas of science and was a creationist. It's because the right knows that science is the underpinnings of an objective reality or of a process in which to produce an objective reality, even if that reality shifts. It's one that which we can agree on. And if we cannot agree on science, then data means nothing. If we cannot agree on the validity of science, then data means nothing. Then it means nothing if we say if we cut Social Security, 32% of our elderly may go into poverty. It means nothing. It's just a number. It means nothing. It's not real. We don't believe it. The Bush administration constantly attacking science. Constantly. For their agenda to, you know, allow corporations to poison our water and our air. So, yes, it is an attack on me. It's an attack on our society. I have no problem people believing it. But it is, make no mistake, when they're actively attempting to supplant science, it's an attack on our society. Kevin Semicolon, great to hear you say sons of bitches on Countdown. Yeah, I wasn't sure if I was supposed to do that. Upbeat Nihilist, are you coming to Netroots Nation this year in Minneapolis? Yes. Any chance of you doing the show and or Ring of Fire from there? Yes, yes. Both, probably. Viper Visor, an actual libertarian on taxes beyond an army, police, and courts. It is simply charity at gunpoint. Taxes for these purposes. Oh, an actual libertarian on taxes beyond an army, police, and courts. It is simply charity at gunpoint. Taxes for these purposes are not necessarily evils, just plain evil. The guy is also against abortion, fine, but he doesn't see the issue in how ideology has zero obligation preventing severe harm or death for anyone post-conception. Well, I don't understand how you can say that there should be police in courts. Well, I don't understand how you say the police. Well, we have to protect our property rights. We have rights to property. But what about general welfare? What about general welfare? What about happiness? I mean, why do you need to put the word happiness in there if you have property in there if they're the same thing? Right? Jimmy Reefer Cake. Sam, a great shoe. Thanks for playing a different Pixie song, UMass. Wicked loud one, dude. You said Mobblehead on Name Drop Friday. Hell yeah. And yeah, science is the key. It's about our survival, for crying out loud. I am referencing what you just said about science. Oh, somehow this applies to the abortion debate. We have no problem with their beliefs. That is evil, but we shouldn't be imposed on all women. Somehow this applies to the abortion debate. We have no problem with their beliefs. That is evil, but it shouldn't be imposed on all women. Yes. Right. Exactly. Okajik. Hi, Sam. I went to a Jesuit high school many years ago in general science class. As a freshman, we were taught evolution. When a wise guy asked the father what he believed as a priest, creation versus evolution, he said with a grin, evolution is hard to beat. Even people of faith who have a slightly open mind accept the science of evolution. To deny it is a blindly radical view. There's plenty of evolutionists who also are very religious, who, you know, at one point in the sort of explanation of how we developed, you run into a brick wall, and that brick wall may very well be God for some people. The Creation Museum was set up to question evolution, not science as a whole. They believe in the scientific method completely. No, they don't. No, they don't. To say that a flag from Scotland is evidence of dinosaurs and humans living contemporaneously is not a scientific method. Creation Museum was set up to question evolution. It's not a questioning of question evolution, not questioning. It's to refute evolution. And evolution is the best answer that science has developed. And so if you are refuting evolution, not questioning it or different elements of it, they wholesale disregard the concept of evolution. And I will quote or paraphrase from the guy from Answers in Genesis. Sam, how do you philosophically reconcile a world where we could have come from apes? How do you philosophically reconcile a world where we could allow a tragedy to happen in that regard? It's not a question of my fucking philosophy. I don't have a philosophical response to us emanating from cousins of apes. Because it's not a question of philosophy. There may be implications to it, but I can't reconcile that any more than I can have to reconcile the philosophical disposition on the fact that it's sunny outside or that it rains. Day-Day Fruit, just wanted to give you a shout-out for the good countdown last night. Thank you. The view that religion must do battle with science is a century-old losing proposition. To many, the pursuit of science is an exploration of God's creation. Besides, like, God gives a damn. Exactly. Right. David, I would say it's not a brick wall. It's a black velvet wall that is full of junk. We just don't know yet. And some people say that we need to continue to search, and some people say that I'm just going to stop, and at that point, I'll say that's what God is. And I'm certainly not against that concept. But I got news for you. Science has found the answers to how long humans have been around, or at least has answers that go that predate 10,000 years ago. They may not have answers to what was going on a million years ago, but... All right, last question. Don't be a putz. This is Name Drop Friday sort of question. Doug Benson recently gathered a dozen comics together for his year-end Doug Loves Movie podcast. Sarah Silverman was the third comic introduced, and before the fourth comic came out, Sarah injected, "Wait, I didn't get my 2 minutes like the other guys did." Since you're friends with so many comics, do you ever notice a similar desperate need for attention besides Marin? Are you serious? You ask me as I take IMs from people with a camera on me and that camera on me? No, never noticed that. Never noticed that. Sarah never required any attention when I... All right, folks, have a great weekend and a great Martin Luther King Day. We will post a podcast for that day. We will not have a live show. We'll be back on Tuesday. And take care. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the lie.